I came back to more grassroots organizing activism very much because I don't believe in the cliche that, you know, you have to put theory into practice and all that. Like, it's rather that they're inseparable. My theory is by going on the street. Like, I get to actually make theory happen.
You're listening to Beyond the Jargon, a conversation with graduate students about their research journeys at the University of Victoria. Welcome to Beyond the Jargon. I'm your host today, Liz MacArthur, and joining me is Sasha Kowalczyk, who is here as a master's student in political science. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
And we got a lot to talk about today, but let's focus in a little bit on what you're studying here at UVic right now, if you can give us sort of an idea of what that is.
Yeah, so right now I'm a Master of Arts candidate in political science, so mm-hmm. I'm in my second year, and my specialization is the international law regarding peacekeepers' legal immunities.
Mm. Interesting. Peacekeepers' legal immunities. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, of course. So when peacekeepers are sent to other countries, they are legally immune from prosecution from the country in which they're stationed. And they're also being part of an international organization, enjoy immunities from international prosecution. But also when the militaries that send them can prosecute them. However, the militaries tend not like, they don't like doing that. Mm. So there's a general culture of impunity when peacekeepers, in times of war, like they're soldiers, nonetheless, they commit crimes.
Interesting. So what kind of information are you drawing from? Are you looking at specific examples of peacekeepers committing crimes?
So that was actually how I started my research. And as I was delving into it, I explored different ways of how to deal with this problem, because it raises a lot of theoretical questions, but also practical ones. And then in consultation with my committee, we have decided to critique or look at the people trying to solve the problem. And there you can kind of see all these structures of discourses, but also law. So you have advocate groups such as the Code Blue campaign run by Stephen Lewis and Romeo Dallaire. They're really advocating for the immunities to be limited to exclude when there's sexual crimes against children. Mm-hmm. And then you have, the UN is aware of this problem. It's an old problem of 20 years old. They have big reports, such as the Prince Zayed report, and they regularly investigate it. So there's this group of scholarship and lawyers who try to work within the system. And then what I really explore is there's a third group of people who decide to try to sue the United Nations or the countries that send the peacekeepers and get around the legal immunity through what's called Jus Cogens law, so international law that supersedes all other laws. So, and then I take that and try to explain all the different actors at play and how those approaches are imperfect, but this last one has a political possibility of going around or transcending this immunity.
When you mentioned that the initial approach to the research posed specific problems, I mean, I can imagine what some of those problems are, but can you give me an example of the sort of challenges you would face if you took that route?
One thing was it was really hard to pick what interest I wanted to concentrate on. And there's this whole other way of reading international politics through kind of a political theoretical lens and talking about ontology in, you know, bringing up art theory and performance of theater and really drawing, really making kind of a more metaphorical work. And I kind of had to put that aside because I would have had to learn so much new theory that I went with something that I was more comfortable with, which is critique of policy. And I drew on what I did in my undergrad, my training from my undergrad, to continue doing the work moving forward. Another thing was I learned a lot in my courses. So things that I, you know, having written a paper and presenting it at conferences, it came apparent to me that there were some major problematic elements of my research, such as I was fixated on the sexual assault part of the of the problem, and that has gained a lot of traction in the media, but that is exploitative of people's crimes, and I don't need to talk about that specific type of crime in order to get attention, especially, you know, as a white male sitting in my ivory tower looking down upon this situation. There were other ways I could use my position and critique the laws of international of peacekeeping immunities.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective to hear as well when you're talking about using your position to, I guess, to critique. Was that a long sort of process to come to that realization and sort of changed your focus as a result?
It was a long process in the sense of the paper changed every time I got critiques, and that was a reoccurring criticism. So it's very much on one side, not wanting to be defensive, but there's that natural inclination of thinking, but I'm doing good work, you know, I'm critiquing the bad guys, or however I would like to frame it. So it was rather not necessarily long, like per time, but it was long to come to peace with, like, okay, I need to do a major change, a major change to my work.
So you shifted the focus then not exclusively to this sort of sexual crimes, but does that mean you broadened it out to encompass other types of crimes? If so, like, what are you talking about?
So I really like this question because it's probably the most frustrating experience, but it's one that I've had to go through undergrad before, is narrowing down the idea, just making it manageable. And so I decided not to encompass other crimes. I decided to concentrate on people trying to change the immunities.
Right, okay.
And really looking at how do people argue or interact in international politics to change the immunities. And from there, I'm able to extrapolate structural things that are happening in international politics, such as international society, that there are deals between countries that that are negligent towards the people when they send peacekeepers there, and that there's little international legal mechanisms to holding two states to account when they contract a deal implicitly to send peacekeepers for whatever interest. And what was so interesting about human rights and groups who represent those who have been harmed by suing those states is a way of saying, okay, we don't really need to change the system, but we're going to try to bring accountability to this other realm. And I use that to say, look, there's this other aspect of peacekeeper crimes. And this is another thing that I had to really change my research, was I don't want to be dismissive of soldiers who have been sent there and put their lives on the line to do maybe the bidding of a corrupt international system. And on top of it, there's a political economy behind peacekeeping where rich states, scared of scandal, contract it out to underdeveloped states such as Nepal and Bangladesh, who provide lots of peacekeepers. And this is a way they hide behind that veil, and they have, in essence, which is a form of mercenary armies. And I don't want to, that's why I really concentrate on international society and its role in peacekeeping, because laying all the blame on one individual or one country misses the entire point, that it's the immunity is expressing a structural flaw behind peacekeeping.
Can you give an example of, you know, you talked about mercenary armies or peacekeepers being hired from, you know, like a Bangladesh providing that, or Nepal. Can you give an example of, you know, when something like that has happened for people to sort of connect to this?
Oh, so the peacekeeping is a office or bureau in the United Nations, and they rely completely on voluntary contributions of states. So it's not like every person in the United Nations gives a tax and then they raise an army. For every mission, they need to have one state agree, okay, I'm going to send this many troops, and then I'm going to send, it's going to be paid by this way, and the ships will be by this person. And every peacekeeping mission is case-by-case basis. There's no regular. So every peacekeeping mission is such a scenario. And there's just been a shift. I guess the exception is Afghanistan, but there's been a shift that most developing states don't send their troops directly in harm's way. But the way Western countries do contribute is they usually foot the bill. And they usually send officials. Now, every time a peacekeeping mission happens, there are two major documents. There's a memorandum of understanding and a status of forces agreement. Those two legal documents sets out who is responsible for when something bad happens. What is the insurance policy? What are the ways to complain? What are the explicit immunities? And that's where the immunities usually are spelt out.
As far as your research has gone so far, how long have you been working on this project now?
Well, I guess it would have to be technically like a year and a half, but it's mm-hmm. kind of hard to say. All throughout my coursework, I always made my coursework, so the papers I wrote for courses about peacekeeping, about different facets. And so the thesis was essentially, it started off from one paper evolving into a thesis. However, this past term has been, I don't want to call it a write-off, but I've had other responsibilities. So it has been a bit more intermittent mm-hmm. the way how much I've written, but you could say it's approaching 2 years, so a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
So you've been focusing on this for a long time. Why? What initially drew you to this?
So I applied to University of Victoria with a completely different idea. Mm-hmm. And it was an idea that really, really confused me. There's a phenomena out there called unrecognized states. So a state that's not legally a country, mm-hmm. but it looks like a country, it acts like a country, but in the law, in the eyes of the law, it isn't one. And there's a slew of these examples. And they've been around for many years. So there's Transnistria in Moldova. There's Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan. One that might be a future contender is the Donetsk People's Republic could become one of these unrecognized states. For a long time, Taiwan is an interesting example. Technically, it's not a country. Hmm. Kosovo looks like it's maybe actually gone past that point, but it's a form of unrecognized state. And when I came to the department and I met with my supervisor, peacekeeping was a sub-example of a phenomena I was trying to write about. And my supervisor advised me that it'd be more interesting and it would draw more, there'd be more materials to examine if I actually talked about peacekeeping. And I was just not opposed to that. It was a fascinating aspect of it. I knew about the peacekeeping immunities. I knew about that there's this weird space in politics, international politics, where anything goes, where you have a radical opening of pure violence that is completely unaccountable. And, you know, an unrecognized state, you can bomb it, you can invade it. And there's nothing really wrong with that because you're not really invading anything. Like Palestine is a good example, right? Like this is not seen as a state. And that I used peacekeeping in that original idea as, look, there's another space where there's pure unaccountable violence.
Through peacekeeping.
But these areas, these spaces in international politics where mm-hmm. anything goes, and another word for it is war. War that isn't called war.
Because these people are called peacekeepers and there is this lack of accountability for it?
Exactly. And war can also only happen between two states. So when you kill a rebel group within your own country, that's called a civil war. That's a different war, but not necessarily the same status as when two states fight.
Mm-hmm. So as far as what your research has been so far, what you've been gathering and looking at, you're critiquing the people who are trying to fix these holes in accountability? Is that it? Or provide solutions to it?
Yeah. Another way of saying problem-solving theories.
Yeah, okay.
Band-aids and no cures.
Interesting. So is that sort of symptomatic of the way that the, I guess, the system is, that there can only be band-aids and no cures? Or are there people that are looking for a cure for it as well?
I guess this is always a problem that critics come into contact with, are we all fatalists? Is this a doomed condition? And I've been told by some professors that at the end of the day, by Cindy Holder, Professor Cindy Holder, who is a professor of philosophy here, at the end of the day, you have to be an optimist or pessimist to some extent. And I would say, no, it's not. I guess I'm an optimist on that. Like, push comes to shove. No, we can't just, like, be resigned to it. Mm-hmm. The people who are trying to fight it, I think that, you know, the Code Blue campaign with Lewis and Dallaire, the good intentions and all that, I guess what I'm arguing is that there's a silence over that cause, and that cause is kind of in front of us or under our noses, and that we're not really talking about the legitimacy of sovereign power, the power of states to do violence. And I think that what really drew me to my current iteration of my idea is that there you can use civil law. You can now civil law, so the idea of suing somebody, it can be merged with humanitarian law, so the idea of war crimes or human rights abuses. And then together you can actually challenge nation states on a completely different level. Mm. And so that's where I see the radical possibility where, you know, very often, you know, a protest can be ignored, but like when money comes into the factor, right, you mm-hmm. know, things change. I'm very, let's say, encouraged by the BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movements. There's one against fossil fuels, but also notably against the Israeli state. Mm. And Israel has taken notice. Israel has its own PR campaigns, and it's been shown that they're putting pressure on those groups and getting their friends in other countries to put pressure on these groups. And for me, that's a promising sign that they're being heard. And yeah, there's plenty of examples of that politics being effective.
So you would see that this sort of combination of humanitarian law and civil law and bringing lawsuits against these states, I'm guessing, is like a positive way to deal with or maybe try to rectify these peacekeeping crimes?
I think so. Yeah. I think that it will make leaders who decide to write the contracts and plan it think twice. And the specific law or technique of law is called tort. So you don't have to even be directly connected to the event. It's not like, let's say, imagine, you know, the United States or Canada is funding the peacekeeping mission. They're not directly involved with the crime that's happening on the ground. But why would you sue the poor country who sent the soldier or the general or whatnot? You can sue by association the people who made it possible. And mm-hmm. so tort law allows individuals to sue people not because there's a contract relation, but because there was a lack of care or negligence elsewhere that made that crime possible. And I think that people will think twice before sending either a poorly trained peacekeeping mission or they don't take the proper preparations for the health and safety of people. And also just peacekeeping in general, people forget that it's war. At the end of the day, it's sending soldiers in into a war place and trying to rectify a political problem through force. And, you know, because crimes will almost inevitably happen, suing the idea that there could be a monetary loss for states and individuals involved in that process, maybe will make them think twice.
Hmm. I'm going to shift the focus for a little bit here and talk a little bit about the fact that you're not just working on your grad thesis, but you're also active in other things in the city and around town. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of activism you're interested in doing? And yeah.
I mean, I guess it's a tricky question, only because I've kind of dabbled in a few things. And unfortunately, sometimes it feels reactionary, such as like when Bill C-51 was passed by Parliament. But when it was put on the floor, House of Commons, that elicited a reaction.
Can you tell us a bit about the bill? Refresh our memories.
Oh yes, Bill C-51. So I describe it as a secret police bill. It is a bill that allows various security agencies to have unfettered access to your information, share it between agencies, share it with foreign governments. There's also amendments that they can completely wipe your bank accounts, and there's a new category of enforcement, which is called disruption warrants, so they can intimidate activists, they can destroy their property. And then there's secret no-fly lists. So there are cases where you go to the airport and you're not allowed on because you're on this list and you never knew, and there's no registry of these lists. And to get off the list, you need to petition the minister. And if they don't read it in time, it just gets indefinitely extended. And there are some serious ramifications for everyone's travel, which is a constitutional right, protest. There's a chilling effect. This is necessary for any democratic society. And lastly, like for your privacy. And, you know, there's a 7-year-old was on one of these no-fly lists.
Right. Yeah.
Sharing information with the CIA has gotten some Canadian citizens tortured before. And protests recently... Our security services don't have a lot of oversight, and recently it's been shown that, you know, 800 peaceful protests were watched by the government. And I don't know why we would give the security apparatus even more power.
Mm-hmm.
So that when that bill came on the floor, when it was proposed, it was impossible not to act.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that you were involved in as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, things that are linked to a deep understanding of like how political systems and stuff work. So it seems to me that, you know, what you're passionate about in school does seem to spill over into things that you're passionate about, you know, when you're not at school. Is that right?
Well, it's a tricky thing in the sense of I guess I don't disagree, but I feel like the order, it's the other way around.
Right,
it was
okay.
Actually, you know, I grew up very privileged. My mother, at the age of 12, brought me to a G20 protest. I was in Toronto. It was one of the first G20s after the Battle of Seattle. And that really showed, that was a great experience just to show me the political possibilities of people uniting. So this interest has nudged me into politics, and it's taken a lot of forms. At one time, I worked for the government, I worked at National Defense and an embassy, and then kind of turned off on that. And then, you know, I just stuck with my theory. And then I came back to more grassroots organizing, activism, very much because I don't believe in the cliche that, you know, you have to put theory into practice and all that. Like this, it's rather that that they're inseparable. That my theory is by going on the street. Like I get to actually make theory happen. You know, solidarity. People may call that abstract. Equality. People might call that abstract. But then I can just go to a rally and prove them wrong because, well, look, here it exists.
That's interesting. Yeah, that idea of theory and practice sort of interlinked like that. Huh. Where do you see yourself going after you finished your master's?
Well, knock on wood. Oh, that's not real wood. There we go. Knock on wood. Let's hope I do finish it. I've very much decided that I never really want to work. I want to stay in the I want to stay in academia. It is an amazing environment. It is a place where there are young people with great ideas, and it is a protected space for free speech and the investigation of those ideas. There are so many groups of other community organizers, but also students, professors. It is very, I guess, utopic for someone who can't see them, who doesn't really identify with a lot of like other work. So I hope, if I have the privilege, to continue on to my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I go into that job market. Hopefully, maybe, I guess this is all conjecture, but
mm-hmm.
maybe postdoc, I don't know, sessional. It's a very intimidating question, because the field and university funding is only going down,
mm-hmm.
and there are more and more PhD applicants, but ultimately that's a good thing. I mean, I wouldn't argue against a better educated society.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. I always like hearing the responses from different people on this show, because some people, you know, the academy isn't for them, and they learn that through their studies, and then they're, you know, they find that out about themselves and they're just like ready to go. But other people, and I think that this is a little more rare, have your reaction, which is, this is the place for me, and I've really found the right fit for me, which is really interesting. And it's good to see that too.
And I feel, on top of that, there are, the master's gave me access to something that I parts of the university I never saw before.
Hmm.
So being spoken to as a peer and being more involved in the university has given me access to how it's governed. There's this other aspect of the master's was a place where I could live out all the dreams I couldn't do in my undergrad. So that's how I got into student politics. And, you know, being part of university governance, Senate committees and hiring committees and all that, you can see that there's actually a lot of politics happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the politics that's going to determine the future for so many people, and also Canada and other nations at large, such as right now the university is grappling with how to implement the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Truth and Reconciliation Committee report. And there are questions about what to do around sexual assault on campus. And so there is a lot of actually politics happening here as well.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Let me check the time. We're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. It was a great conversation. And good luck with your studies. And I'm glad that it seems like you're fish in water here.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Jargon. If you're interested in being interviewed, please email cfuvcad@uvic.ca. To listen again, you can find a link to the podcast at cfuv.ca.